Hello, and welcome to episode 4 of the CashCast, a podcast that gives you the latest insights and updates into the world of cash and voucher assistance.
My name's Julie Lawson McDowell, and I'm CALP's Knowledge Management and Research Coordinator. I lead our work stream on linking humanitarian cash with social protection as a response to crisis.
Today we'll be exploring how to link social protection and humanitarian cash and voucher assistance. The question at the heart of this podcast is, what do we really know and where to start with linking social protection and humanitarian CVA? This episode of the CashCast has come about because CALP has just released a high-level briefing paper on these linkages. The origins of the work lie back in 2019 when we were trying to think about how to revise our capacity building work in this area. But we weren't sure what the needs were, what the audience was, and where we as CALP would actually add value. Was there already a great deal of capacity building work in this area, or was there still a place where we could add value? With generous funding from the German Federal Foreign Office, we commissioned a very expert team from Humanitarian Outcomes to update us on the latest developments in this critical but really rather complex area, and to give us some ideas about what might be needed, what sort of partnerships we might think about making, and what sort of capacity building work would be most useful. Three of the participants in this podcast were authors of this report. Paul Harvey is a humanitarian with over 20 years as an aid worker, researcher, and consultant. And Paul was an early leader in thinking about how to use cash in humanitarian contexts. So hello, Paul.
Hello.
Daniel Longhurst is an independent consultant, and he brings a background of climate change adaptation and disaster risk management to his experience of social protection and humanitarian response. Daniel is currently part of DFID and GIZ's Space COVID-19 Hub, which provides technical advice to over 20 countries in facing the pandemic. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Judy.
Rachel Sabatis Wheeler from the Institute of Development Studies is a development economist who focuses on analysing risk, vulnerability, and poverty. And she's been an important influence in most of the social protection frameworks we use today. Hi, Rachel.
Hi there.
Now, we have a special guest to give us the perspective on how linking humanitarian cash and voucher assistance with social protection works in the specific and really incredibly important case. We are very happy to be joined today by Orhan Hasimehmet, the coordinator of the Turkish Red Crescent's humanitarian cash response. Orhan leads the largest regular humanitarian intervention in the world, the Emergency Social Safety Net, which is funded by the EU and which allows millions of refugees in Turkey to meet their basic needs and to access education in a dignified fashion. Hello, Orhan.
Hello, Julie.
So, let's get started. Paul, could you, just to get us started, could you set the scene with a brief summary of the findings and the insights from this state-of-the-art report?
Yes, pleasure. So as we start to review, it's clear that there's a sort of clear and compelling case for social assistance to flex in response to crises and for humanitarian cash to link better to national systems of social assistance. And that's sort of long been a clear theoretical case. The old problem was that whilst it was a good idea, there was limited application in practice where it was most needed in the poorest countries in the world and in humanitarian crisis. That's becoming less true. So as we start to review, there's no shortage of frameworks. There's a growing body of practice and guidelines, learning to draw on, and real progress being made in a wider range of contexts. For a long time, everyone talked about the hunger safety net in Kenya and the food safety net in Ethiopia, and there weren't many other examples. But now, as we'll hear in Turkey, across the Sahel, in the Caribbean, across the globe, there's a growing, and COVID responses are seeing a huge expansion again of ways in which social assistance is flexing to respond to the COVID pandemic. So the challenge in doing the review was partly sort of making sense of this plethora of initiatives to avoid stepping on two toes and to find something new to say. In doing that, we asked why, if the case is so clear and compelling, has it been so hard in practice to link humanitarian cash and social assistance? And why has it taken so long for the growing body of practice that we've talked about to emerge? And we argued that there was a tendency to overlook fundamental differences in principles, approaches, and ways of working between humanitarian and development actors. And that if you overlook them, then it's easy just to focus on the technical and assume that what needed is more training, policy, tools and guidance, and basically to tell people that they need to link social protection to humanitarian cash and how to do it. And that's necessary but not sufficient. We argue in the report that there are particular challenges and political choices and dilemmas that need to be faced and navigated, and those classes of a principle and approach need to be sort of more explicit. We also argue a note for caution that making social assistance ever more complex and able to flex in response to shocks isn't necessarily and always the way forward. Sometimes you might still want separate emergency response capacity and separate humanitarian responses, which are sort of complementary to long-term social assistance. And that the best way for social assistance to support resilience and to enable people to recover from crisis might be to keep it simple in some places. We also argue that dilemmas of principle and politics need to be more explicit, that often in assuming that you can straightforwardly link social assistance and humanitarian cash, there's neglect of people in areas not controlled by states, or neglect of people that governments don't accept that should be part of national systems, such as refugees or internally displaced people. And some of these dilemmas aren't amenable to technical fixes. You need soft skills and ethical frameworks to make choices around difficult dilemmas, not just training in the sort of technical aspects of how to link social protection and humanitarian cash. So the report as a whole, whilst summarising the clear and compelling case for social assistance to link better to humanitarian cash and for the opportunities to do that that are emerging in all sorts of places, it also argues the need for caution in so doing and the sort of careful navigation of when and how to work with governments, the soft skills that are needed in thinking through the ethical dilemmas that are sometimes presented of trying to do this in complex or in fragile settings, and the need for thinking in terms of capacity building and ways in which we can strengthen our ability to link social protection and humanitarian cash to look at soft skills as well as technical skills. And on that, I'll hand back to Jude.
Thanks, Paul. That was a really good summary. So thinking about where the challenges can lie, can I turn to you, Orhan? Can you tell us a little bit about how the emergency social safety net has been linking social protection and humanitarian cash? And, you know, as an example, we're all facing the crisis that is the COVID-19 pandemic. How have you made adjustments and adapted to that?
Thank you, Julie. I'll take you very quickly through the Turkey context. So since 2011, the Turkish Red Crescent operates a digital platform aims to provide humanitarian cash to the Turkish nationals who are in need in Turkey. So in 2012, actually, this platform was extended and improved to serve refugees as well. Today, 2.4 million refugees are receiving monthly, bi-monthly and quarterly cash assistances through this platform, Kızılaykap platform, which all link to the existing social protection schemes in Turkey. The collaborative approach linkages are multilateral, multi-layered, and comprehensive. The lead implementer is the Social Assistance Directorate General under the Ministry of Family, Labor, and Social Services. However, as said, in different layers, the Minister of National Education, the Migration Management Directorate General, the Civil Registry and Population Directorate General, the Minister of Health, the International Labor Directorate General, and Disaster Management Presidency are all part of this process. Here, the backbone of the information management system are the Integrated Social Assistance Information System for the Social Assistance Directorate General under the Ministry, and the Göçmen System Information System for the TRC. The strong infrastructures and robust systems allowed the delivery at scale, timely, and adaptability, and even the complementarity with the broader programming as well. As is outlined in the high-level briefing paper, and as Paul has mentioned here, it is required for the soft skills along with the hard skills. I'll give you some examples, as stated by Paul as well. The negotiation is very important. The collaborative approach is very important. The leadership plays a very important role over here. The coordination with the government and non-governmental humanitarian actors is very important. Seconding staff also on a central level, on a field level, is very important. Providing additional support, for example, for transportation is very important. Peer-to-peer learning is very important, and the ownership is very important over here. So yeah, as stated, the soft skills are very important, along with the necessary hard skills as well. Due to the huge influx of refugees in Turkey in considerably short time, TRC filled the gap to meet the needs and apply the humanitarian imperative to this context as well. So again, giving very quick examples like the need-based approach, mainstreaming the protection, the inclusiveness of the communities, including refugees, of course, two-way feedback mechanism, establishing what is existing and providing more innovation on this, prioritizing the most vulnerable people and data protection. So as you say, Julie, actually, of course, we face some challenges. I will give you two of them, and I would like to highlight how we overcome this. So one example is about the traditional, actually, transfer value discussions. Here, TRC and WFP, the ex-partner of the Emergency Social Safety Net, was based on the calculation on the minimum expenditure basket. We tried to fill the gap so the household could meet their basic needs. The government asked this transfer value not to exceed much the average value of the existing social assistance provided to the Turkish nationals. But actually, the result was a win-win. And how? We agreed on a specific value below the need, which exceeded a little bit the government social assistance average to the nationals. But furthermore, we added seasonal top-ups and extra additions in value to meet specific needs of the most vulnerable. So we tried to balance that transfer value to meet our need-based approach. Another example is about the additional economic support to cope the COVID-19 impact. Turkey announced about 140 euros top-up for 5.5 million Turkish nationals. The same positive political will was existing for the refugees, but the timing was not clear, and this created a big challenge for us. However, through the negotiation and the meetings on a technical level and the high level, supported by the leadership also, TRC, IFRC, and the Minister of Family, Labor and Social Services finished the preparations, and thanks to the EU funding, we made two tranches, 7 euro for each, and we started to deliver those cash assistances since June. So we made one tranche, and the other will be following on July as well. So as a result, this shows how the existing shock-responsive social protection network in Turkey was able to adapt under this major pandemic. Over to you, Julie.
Thanks. I mean, it is fascinating the way that COVID-19 has sort of, in a way, become a major test for this approach of trying to link social protection and humanitarian CDA. And I suspect that Turkey is soon going to become one of those, you know, go-to examples of how it should be done, particularly in the range of ways you've approached the challenges, the extreme need for coordination amongst different ministries and different humanitarian actors, and also in the way you've responded very quickly to the COVID-19 crisis. Daniel, you're part of a hub that is giving advice to about 20 countries in how to respond to COVID-19 using linkages between social protection, humanitarian, CDA. Does this rather sort of best example, does it resonate with the experiences that you're having, the advice you're giving at the moment?
Yes, we certainly see that other countries have been facing the same challenges and coming up with similar solutions to those that Orhan was speaking about. Obviously, for the space mechanism, we have to be cognizant of the fact that a lot of the countries that are reaching out are perhaps the ones that are a little less well capacitated or where coordination is more of a challenge. And therefore, we're looking to support need support, rather, in the options that they can use in terms of social protection and humanitarian assistance to address the COVID crisis. So there's three points that Orhan mentioned that I wanted to pick up on. The first is that we're seeing across all these countries that there's some of these difficult decisions about aligning transfer values. Alignment in general, but you know, the nitty-gritty gets down to transfer values, for instance, as well as targeting. So on average, we're seeing that the social protection programs that have been scaled for the COVID response are much higher in terms of their transfer value than the average social assistance transfer value, but they're often only one-offs. So we're seeing also some interesting discussions about aligning the social assistance transfer values to those of the minimum expenditure basket used by the humanitarians, but that's also rarer. The second issue that I wanted to pick up on is timing. So this is a key challenge. And of course, Orhan mentioned how it's important to align what international actors, what humanitarian assistance is saying versus what the government is trying to achieve and trying to do that in an evidence-based way. So here, We've seen that there's been, for instance, some amazing announcements about social protection and different social protection systems scaling to meet need around COVID. But there have been a lot of delays. There's been delays between the announcement and the disbursements. There's been delays when it comes down to the actual planning. There's been delays because the program in question has been overwhelmed with requests, if you're talking about on-demand style programs. So this has also been difficult because existing programs don't always cover the areas where the need is greatest. And it re-emphasizes the point that we need to be coordinating so that we at least know, as different programs become available to address need or have different areas that they cover that could be scaled to address COVID need, that that's being done as far as possible in a coordinated and sort of deliberate way, and that interventions can be sequenced. The third point, last point I wanted to mention, is around coordination. So we've seen some positive examples of multi-partner coordination forums, for instance, across humanitarian assistance and social protection, trying to link up. Some of them, you know, like cash transfer working groups, are actually writing it into their TORs. Social protection coordination mechanisms are trying to reach out to humanitarian actors. And so we're seeing that there are some new constellations of coordination appearing in an ad hoc way. But we see a lot of fragmentation, and I would say that we see more fragmentation than some of these green shoots of coordination. And we're facing some old and familiar foes here. There's not enough time for partners to coordinate. There's not really any promise of new resources in coordination, which is, you know, a time-consuming and slow exercise that requires patience. However, we know that actors, as I said, can't all mobilize at the same time. So we need that coordination, and we need that kind of move towards a more conscious approach to enhancing the comprehensiveness, coverage, and adequacy of support to those most in need. Now, shock responsive social protection, as with all the other concepts that try and bring people together, like the nexus, like resilience, linking relief, recovery, and development, all of these hinge on coordination. So definitely this is one of the things that we need to keep re-emphasizing has to be done right. Thank you.
I'm just going to provide a couple of reflections on what has already been said in various forms. So we, in our report, in our high-level briefing paper, we do talk about these soft skills. We've heard a little bit about that from Orhan and Paul. But I would also say, just pushing back a little bit, the hard skills also obviously are very important, particularly when we think about decentralizing the whole shock responsive system, or this ability to flex in response to shocks down to a very local level. And what we've seen in places like Ethiopia in response to the 2017-18 food crisis, that even though there was a fantastic response, shock response, scalable safety net response at the national, federal level, when you started looking at lower levels, there were a lot of constraints around harmonization, things that we've discussed around the equivalence of the transfer values, how the distribution of the cash happened versus food. And there was also issues around just not enough budget being devolved downwards. So while there was a lot of knowledge at a federal level and in terms of policy space and what should be happening at the local level, things were not able to keep up. So I'm sorry, raising that as something quite important when we think about how we go about responding to these shocks and how we set up systems, because it really is about systems. The other thing that Daniel just raised was World Bank work that has been led by Ugo Gentilini that has looked and tracked the response post-COVID of globally all countries in terms of their social assistance or social protection. And we've seen there's been a massive response. However, when you look at that report and all the data they're collecting, if you disaggregate by the wealth or the development of a country, you see that it's very, very, very uneven. It's highly unequal. And the poorer countries, those that do not have the capacity to respond, are not able, more or less. And so what you see is over time, if we see countries like the UK and Europe and the US able to respond quickly, whereas other countries lagging behind, we're going to see even bigger sort of gap growing between the wealthy and the poorest. And one of the problems, the reason why this happens, is because different countries and different regions have very different capacities and systems to be able to cope. So some work done by the FAO a couple of years ago
showed that depending on the context you're in, the social protection context, whether you've got a very well-established system versus other countries which might not have good systems like South Sudan or Somalia, they may have broken or nascent systems. You cannot immediately start to move into a shock responsive mode or a scalable mode. You have to work through humanitarian actors and think about what you can put in place to actually build on and create a system. So there's a lot of inequality that's likely to become very stark post-COVID and in terms of the social protection, socialist response after COVID. And we're going to see that panning out. And I would very much say, you know, we need to think big. We need to think soft skills, hard skills, but we also need to think back to basics for quite a lot of countries, food security and making sure we are covering the most vulnerable as well. Thanks.
No, I think that's a really good point. It made me think back to 2011, 2012 in northern Kenya when I was working with UNICEF and the Red Cross and the government. We were trying to have a really rapid response in the north of Kenya to the really severe food insecurity up there. And the idea was to work with a local partner and the government with this external funding to have something that would be quickly in place. And it took 6 months to get money to people. I think it's about 6 months, don't quote me on that. But without the systems being in place in advance, it just couldn't be done rapidly. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that one sees in other countries that perhaps isn't so clear when we talk about linking social protection systems with humanitarian cash, that quite often in a large number of less developed contexts, the social protection system itself has only just begun to get established and it's only covering a very small percentage of the population and which percentage is covered, whether it's in terms of extreme poverty, where targeting is difficult, or certain vulnerable categories such as old age. These systems really aren't that well developed. And to expect them to be able to respond to major shocks and, you know, anywhere in the country at any time without quite a lot more time and investment and planning and funding and, as you say, devolution of funding. It's a lot to ask, which I think leaves a role for humanitarians. But maybe, you know, one of the points to take out of this report and a lot of recent learning is that humanitarians need to start approaching some of their work with a different mindset about how they develop certain systems or approaches.
Yeah, so I would agree definitely with that. I just wanted to also point out that obviously the COVID crisis has been very shocking globally. And in terms of social protection, it's a very new type of shock. Social protection isn't used to this kind of epidemiological shock. And it's social protection as a community, as a system, as provision is trying to understand how to deal with that. Because when we think about some of the poorest people in the poorer regions of the world, this is just one extra shock that compounds all the other shocks they're facing. And so we need to keep in mind that depending on the places and the countries and the population groups we're serving, there will be a very different sort of shock profile. And COVID might just not even be the biggest shock they're facing. For example, they might be facing swarms of locusts on their crops. So we just need to keep all of that in mind as we move ahead in this sphere of shock response and linking humanitarian and social protection.
Paul or Orhan, do you want to jump in and share some thoughts? I mean, I'm wondering, you know, for example, about, you know, Rachel saying here are the very poorest and for them, this is just one other shock and it might not be the most important shock. But we're hearing a lot about the uncounted middle or the missing middle. Have you any thoughts about how, or have you heard about ways in which humanitarians or governments in the poorer contexts are trying to address this?
Well, I would like to highlight that Rachel has said that, yes, the hard skill is very important. And the bigger at scale that you are, the requirement of this and maybe the running pace of it is coming more slowly. And we acknowledge that making the response in a timely manner and keeping the seclusion at a minimum level, it is very important. But however, the reality on the ground, it differs when it goes to poorer countries or countries with a less infrastructure or less resources, including the capacity of the human resources or the financial resources as well. How to overcome it? I believe that there should be a base for such as shock responsive systems, being aware that the humanitarian actors should stay there to complement and to fill the gap. There will always be a gap, even in the most developed countries in the world, I believe, and in Turkey as well, there is a gap. And we need the humanitarian actors to fill many of them. Mainstreaming the protection, for example, it won't be accomplished 100% if we don't engage the protection partners. So I believe that, yes, going into one module, saying that the shock-responsive social protection systems are being able to timely respond and to be having that systematic timely response is always the way that we do the response is not correct. But yeah, it is a very reliable and accountable resource of mechanism. And one example of that right now, I would like to say, we were doing this program since 3 years, the Emergency Social Safety Net. And the first time that we are getting big thanks from the beneficiaries and the people who are affected from the ground through the telephones. So they are calling the call center, they are waiting for a couple of minutes. And then they are saying, thanks for meeting our need. We were having a need and thanks for meeting our needs. And this assures that, yes, we are capturing some of them through this social safety net. However, the role for the humanitarian actors still remains and still need to be explored. How to do further coordination? And this is what Daniel have said about the level of the coordination. Yeah, it's very important to put great efforts on the coordination, but this is not easy at all.
So maybe just as we begin to wrap up, Rachel said that she thinks the COVID-19 shock in particular has shown us how we do need some of the hard skills. But going back to the report, which really promoted the idea that we have to have the skills in place to analyse each context in its own right and focus not so much on what system we're using, but how to achieve the best outcomes for the affected populations. Paul, do you think that the findings of the report still hold up in the COVID-19 era?
Well, yeah, I mean, clearly COVID is demonstrating more than ever both the sort of need and the opportunities to find ways to link humanitarian cash and social assistance. As Rachel says, one of the features of COVID is its sort of global nature and at a national level, the fact that it affects the whole country, or at least the effects of lockdowns and restrictions affect everyone across the country. And so the sort of traditional ways of thinking about targeting and vulnerability are definitely challenged. And it's, I think, producing a move back to thinking about how to work at really large scale and how to work with national systems and the importance of doing that. And in doing that, the importance of governments. And it slightly calls into question, therefore, what the role of international humanitarian actors are. Where do they fit into this national system-focused need for large-scale support? But I think there is still a role, both in the places where national systems have their limitations, and in what Rachel was talking about, in the sort of focus on exclusion and focus on what's actually happening at sub-national levels. So sometimes you can have lovely national systems on paper, but when you're looking at what's actually happening at ground level in particular districts or geographies, then it's more limited. And so I think there continues to be a role for sort of civil society, both national and international, to highlight gaps, to focus on particular aspects of exclusion and vulnerability, and to sort of both complement and substitute for national systems. There are obviously huge challenges in doing that. One of which, you know, targeting has always been massively complex, and COVID, I think, sort of adds another layer of complication, both in the fact that it's often different geographies. For instance, pandemics might be at their worst in cities rather than in rural areas. And as Rachel was saying, there may be overlapping vulnerabilities. If you're in Somalia, you're coping with the consequences of lockdown and the locust infection and conflict and so on. And then the other challenge, of course, is one of proximity, what Ornham was just talking about. If the agencies that try and support people, both government and non-governmental, are themselves constrained in their ability to get out and talk to people, then finding who's vulnerable, how to support them, who's been excluded and who's not, is going to be difficult. And so thinking about ways in which you can sort of maintain sort of proximity and solidarity with the poorest in the most difficult countries in the world is also going to be a big challenge as the response to the COVID crisis unfolds and as countries cope with overlapping crises. But I think all of which is to say that the opportunities to link humanitarian cash and social protection are there more than ever, but there's lots of thinking that needs to be done and is happening in places like space about, and in particular countries, as Orhan's been talking about, how hard it is to do that well. And that's where both governments and international agencies can work together to try and do that better.
Thank you. So I'm going to say thank you very much. That was a great conversation and I can't say how much I've enjoyed the whole period of this study. I think it's been a huge learning curve and you've really helped us think about the way forward. So thank you everybody. And that concludes this episode of the Cashcast. Anyone wishing to know more could watch the webinar launching this report, which took place on May the 21st.
and it was hosted by the Grand Bargain Sub-Work Group on Linking Social Protection and Humanitarian CDA and socialprotection.org. Link to this from the CALC website or through socialprotection.org, where you will also find much other similar related material. The full report on which this podcast is based is available on the CALC website, where you'll also find a whole range of other blogs, videos and resources on calpnetwork.org. The Cashcast is available on all of the top directories, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify and Google Podcasts. And you can, of course, rate and subscribe. If you have any topic ideas for future episodes of the Cashcast, then do get in touch with us. You can contact us via Facebook, LinkedIn or Twitter, or you can email us. Our address is info@calpnetwork.org. Thank you very much for listening today, and we do hope you'll join us for the next episode. Thank you.